Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast channel here on New Books Network. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, the host of the channel, and today we're talking to Dr. Irene Mulvey, who is the president of the American Association of University Professors. And today she's giving us an inside look into that association. Welcome to the show, Irene.
Thank you so much, Christina. I am delighted to be invited to your podcast and really excited to have this conversation with you.
I am so glad that you're here and that we get this inside look. And I know there's a number of things you're excited to share with us today and things you're passionate about that your organization is advocating for. But before we jump into that, would you please tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. I am a professor of mathematics at Fairfield University, where I've been teaching for 37 years. So I think, if people do the subtraction, you can figure out that I sort of got my PhD and came of age in the 1970s as part of the women's movement. And I felt very supported in that era to get a PhD in mathematics. I am also a mom. I have three grown adult children, and education, higher education, is my passion.
If we could circle back a little bit and talk about when you were a student, how did you decide on mathematics? When did you know that was what you wanted to do?
I was always very good in math. I was really good in math at high school. I went to an all-girls Catholic school, which I think there were, fewer distractions, and I was able to be good in math without feeling that it was odd for a girl to be good at math. And then I went into college, planning to major in math. And I still, even when I got to the higher levels of math, I still liked it. I still enjoyed it very much. And I had great teachers and faculty professors that mentored me and suggested I go on to higher ed. I will say, I am a first-generation college student. Neither of my parents went to college. I'm one of five children, and all five went to college, which was very important to my parents. So I know how higher ed is an engine of social mobility, or it used to be an engine of social mobility, where you really could move forward without incurring tons and tons of student debt, which is a terrible problem brought about by the underfunding of higher education. But back to your question, I was a senior in college, and one of the faculty members in a class said to us, a class of math majors, so who's going to graduate school? And I said, graduate school, what's that? I had no idea. But, this faculty member was really good at mentoring us, helping us figure out how to apply, where to apply, and what we might do. I got my PhD at Wesleyan University, which is a small PhD program. So I was also extremely well supported there by the faculty. I think it was, if I had been 10 years younger, it would have been more difficult. You'd be fighting for your chance. But somehow, starting my PhD program in 1977, the end of the decade where the women's movement really took hold, was fortuitous. And I feel that I know people look back and think we were trailblazers. In a sense, we were trailblazers, but we were really supported as a result of the women's movement. And then from there, I went into higher ed, where I've been, like I said, teaching for 40 years.
And when you went into higher ed, was tenure track a given? If you got hired as a professor, you could expect that you were on the tenure track and that was accessible and a real thing for you?
Yes. When I got my first job in 1985, pretty much everyone in the job market that year was looking for tenure track jobs, expecting tenure track jobs. The jobs we were applying for were tenure track jobs. It was absolutely the norm at that time, unlike now, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But certainly my first job was a visiting position, a 3-year visiting position, because it was the best year I got. And I used it as a stepping stone towards a tenure track job. But the norm absolutely for people getting PhDs back in the 70s and 80s was a tenure track position. That was the goal, and that was achievable for nearly everyone.
And it sounds like you had mentors along the way. And if I'm reading what you said so far correctly, your family was rooting you on.
Yeah, my family, I don't know if they knew what to make of it once it was past a bachelor's degree, but they're all very supportive. I mean, my parents were very supportive. I have a brother that has a master's degree, but I'm the only one that went past that for a PhD. So I don't think they knew what to make of it, my parents, but absolutely, I have a very supportive family. We're very close. We're all grown up now, facing retirement. The real mentorship was at the universities, because my parents would not have known the first thing about graduate degrees, how to apply, where to apply, how to get funding. So the real mentorship came from the faculty that taught me in these schools I went to.
And I think that's true for a lot of us. We may have relatives who want to root us on, but they're not going to give us the roadmap.
Right. I agree completely. Yeah, the roadmap, really, that's our job as faculty people did it for me, and now it's my job as a faculty member. And not just the faculty member, the departments should have that kind of support for students who want to go into graduate school or want to do anything. So, right, it's up to the universities, the departments, and the faculty to help the students. That's part of what higher education should be doing. It's so many things. It should be an opener of minds and engine of social mobility, and also an economic driver for their communities. But in terms of helping people who live in a democracy move forward, higher education is, in my view, and in the view of the AAUP, higher education is a public good. It should serve the public good in so many different ways. And one of those ways is in helping the students who attend the schools to move forward as informed citizens.
So let's get into what the AAUP is. It was founded in 1915. Why was it founded, and what is the mission?
That's a great question. The AAUP was founded in 1915 by faculty members. And at the time, the faculty saw the threats to the profession that came from inappropriate interference into our work. So the 1915 Declaration of Principles, which was drafted at a preliminary meeting, was intended, and I put this in quotes, quote, to make collective action possible. So in the first instance, the AAUP was founded to organize the profession in order to protect the profession and support the profession. Almost immediately, the leaders of the organ of the formation of the AAUP started getting reports of interference in higher education. So, for example, I may not have all the details. This is basically the story. At Stanford, some faculty members were fired by the widow of the Leland Stanford, the benefactor, because she didn't like their research into railroad monopolies. And Stanford had made his money in the railroad industry. So this is the first notification to the AAUP that of the threat to academic freedom. And so since then, I mean, within the first year, the AAUP set up this Committee on Academic Freedom, and they've been investigating violations of academic freedom. So even though technically our organization was founded to make collective action possible, really, its main focus is academic freedom. Advancing academic freedom, protecting academic freedom is the AAUP's core mission. Our founders recognize that academic freedom is what's essential for the profession. It's needed for teaching. You know, you can't have someone tell you, you must say this in the classroom. You can't say that in the classroom. That's completely antithetical to what higher education should be. So academic freedom is needed in teaching. Academic freedom is needed in research, not for the individual faculty member to do whatever they want, but the academic freedom is for the work. The work should be able to go wherever it leads without interference from someone who doesn't like where that work is going. So it's not academic freedom for the individual teacher. It's academic freedom for the work. And then you have to have academic freedom. Another component of academic freedom is to be able to speak up about the institution. If you want to criticize the institution, complain about how much money is being put into athletics, or that the budget is prioritizing non-academic initiatives, academic freedom protects an individual from speaking up like that. And finally, the fourth is extramural utterances. A faculty member should be protected, should have the same free speech rights as any other person, and shouldn't be disciplined for you know, something they say on Twitter or in an op-ed. So I think our main focus is academic freedom, and I can certainly talk about that for many hours. And our secondary focus is shared governance, that in higher education, there are, it's different from the corporate world or other places, because the faculty have expertise in their fields that far surpasses the academic expertise in that field of board members or the administrators or the presidents. So faculty, because of their academic expertise, have a responsibility and an obligation to they should have decision-making authority over anything over which they have primary responsibility. So this is, for example, curriculum, hiring, tenure, promotion, anything that focuses on academics, research. These are all matters over which faculty must exercise primary responsibility. And so in an institution where shared governance is working properly, in those areas over which faculty exercise primary responsibility, they make decisions which are upheld by the administration and the board. So those are our two basic focuses, academic freedom and shared governance.
And I know something that's of real concern to you is what's going on with tenure in higher ed and what we should all do about it. Do you want to talk to us about your thoughts, particularly as a person who had the opportunity to pursue tenure and whose cohort had the same opportunity? And you just can't tell grad students that today.
Right. Right. I have two children in academics. One managed to get a tenure track job, and the other is does not have a tenure track position yet. But this is it's a great thing to have brought up. You cannot talk about academic freedom without including tenure, because academic freedom is not protected without tenure. The whole point of tenure is to protect academic freedom. And so when a faculty member is granted tenure after 7 years in the full-time in the profession, they cannot be fired, except they can be fired, but they can't be disciplined or fired except for adequate cause following an adjudicative hearing before an elected faculty body at which the administration has to make the case for discipline or dismissal. So academic freedom is a wonderful concept, but it's not protected unless the faculty member has tenure. So, and tenure requires this academic due process that I just articulated. So in lots of places right now, they are attacking tenure. They're attacking tenure as if tenure is just job security or just some perk that that professors get that people in other professions don't get. And that is a complete mischaracterization of tenure. Tenure protects academic freedom. If you do away with tenure, then there's no more academic freedom. So these attacks on tenure are attacks on academic freedom, and attacks on academic freedom are attacks on higher education as a public good necessary in a democracy. And I think what you're probably alluding to, or what many people probably listening to your podcast will may know, is that the percent of professors that have tenure or are in tenure stream positions or that are tenure eligible has decreased dramatically over the last several decades. And so the vast majority of faculty teaching today do not have tenure, do not have any opportunity to get tenure, and they're off the tenure track, they're contingent faculty. And as a result, this is a terrible thing for higher ed, because without tenure, there's no protection for academic freedom. It's a real problem which we're fighting against. We've been fighting against it. You know, we've been fighting for academic freedom since our founding in 1915, but now, and we're still fighting for academic freedom. It has to be constantly protected. But now the attacks have decoupled tenure from academic freedom, which makes it easier to portray tenure as just some fancy perk for the elite, and, you know, make it a talking point for politicians to throw red meat to the base, as opposed to understanding what really happens when you attack tenure is you lose academic freedom in their institutions, which is, you know, the whole point. I mean, and faculty are never going to stop fighting for this. I mean, these attacks on tenure, which are attacks on academic freedom, it's the kind of thing faculty will never quit fighting for, because it's why we went into this profession. It's why we went into our why we do our scholarship, why we teach.
With so much of the instruction being done by contingents at many schools, it's 80% of the teaching is done by visiting professors, graduate students, people who are hired just to teach for a semester or for a year. It strikes me that the students also lose academic freedom, because if you can't stay in touch with the professor who got you started on your research project, or who inspired you, or who is in fact perhaps the one obscure expert in the world on the, you know, rare kind of moss that you want to research, the students lose their freedom as well, because they can't keep working with these instructors who are moving from school to school to school.
Right. This problem of contingency, or sometimes we call it the adjunctification of the profession, is problematic in so many ways. First of all, for the reason you describe, that if your faculty member doesn't have any kind of job security at the institution you're at, you may not be able to continue your studies with that faculty member. But even more, more day-to-day, a lot of faculty are teaching part-time. They have to cobble together courses at several different institutions in order, you know, they're paid something like $2,000 to $5,000, on average, probably $4,000 a course. So they're cobbling together, you know, a couple of courses at several different institutions they have no time to spend with their students. They have no, they're not available for office hours. They don't have an office usually. They don't have an extension or, where people can reach them. So they're, it, the quality of education suffers for the students, absolutely, because these people are scrambling around trying to make ends meet. I'm aware of contingent faculty who are cobbling together. First of all, let's be clear. These are people who went, you know, to college and then got a graduate degree and spent all this time on the training and the academic to gain the academic expertise to work in some field, to really become an expert. And now they find themselves unable to get a job where they can make a living doing this work that it's like a gig economy. I mean, it's like being an Uber driver or a Lyft driver, but doing that after spending 10 years getting trained to do your scholarship and God knows how much student debt, incurring so much student debt. So it's this adjunctification of the profession, this problem of contingency results in a diminishment of the quality of education. There's just no way when these faculty are worried about, do I have enough money to pay my rent, that they can provide, you know, full attention to their students. And so this, the faculty, it's an outrage what the living conditions that faculty members are being forced to live in this day and age in higher education. And it's terrible for the students. And the couple that with the I don't have the statistics with me at hand, but at many institutions, the amount of full-time administrators is increasing. We refer to it as administrative bloat, where there's a new vice president for this and there's a new associate dean for that. And these are full-time employees making much more, you know, making high salaries. And the whole point of the institution is to provide education, and they're delegating that to people probably under the poverty line, relying on food stamps and other government assistance after being trained as experts. It's shameful. It's absolutely shameful exploitation. And I wish more people knew about it. I wish when people took their students on their high school students on college tours, they would ask, how many of the courses are taught by adjunct faculty? How many of the courses are taught by contingent faculty? What percentage of the faculty have tenure? It's shameful exploitation. I mean, we can go to the root of it. There's a couple of causes. There's, first of all, we've had decades of disinvestment in higher education at the federal and state level. And that disinvestment has been passed on to the students in terms of higher tuition and in the faculty in terms of, fewer full-time and more adjuncts.
I think it's so hard for students, and if they have family financial support to go to school, it's very hard for their families to understand as well, because the tuition price is the same whether the professor teaching it is tenured or the professor teaching it is getting $2,000 for teaching the entire course.
That's exactly right. The tuition is the same no matter who's teaching the course. And in some classes, as you said, in some places, it's up to 80% of the faculty are getting paid $4,000 to teach a course. And in others, beginning faculty, depending on the area of the country, could be getting $60,000 or $70,000 a year with benefits. The adjuncts, not only do they get paid next to nothing, they typically don't have benefits. They don't have health insurance. They're not being able to put away money into their retirement. It's complete exploitation, and students and their families don't may not understand the extent of it.
When they're looking at the tuition bill, I think they can't fathom what we're talking about. You know, the cost of tuition, if you don't have financial aid, is substantial, as you said. And it just wouldn't occur to anybody, I think, to ask, are the people teaching these classes being well paid? Because you're looking at what you're paying for tuition and you're assuming, of course they are. I can see the bill.
Right, right. Absolutely. I'm sure that's exactly what happens. People are assuming people are well paid because look at what I'm paying for this education. Yeah.
And so the AAUP is very concerned about tenure, and they're concerned about collective bargaining and all the faculty feeling like they're in this together. What approaches do you advocate, and how do people become part of this movement?
That's a great question. We are all about, I mean, our organization is a grassroots organization. We are, every member in the AAUP is a member of a chapter. Most of these chapters are at institutions. You know, if you don't have enough members at an institution to have a chapter, you're in our so-called at-large chapter. But most of our work is done at the grassroots levels by members in chapters. And so our goal is to organize faculty into AAUP chapters wherever we can. We're a historic organization. We've been around for 1915. We've been setting the standards for this profession for 107 years. We have all sorts of statements on contingent faculty, and that contingent faculty should be allowed to serve in governance on faculty senates and so on. You know, we have a lot of statements on contingent faculty. We've been working hard on that, and I think right now, the organizing movement of unionization is inspiring, and it's difficult. There's some hurdles to organizing full-time faculty at private institutions, and there's some hurdles to organizing full-time faculty at public institutions in certain states. But contingent faculty organizing does not have the same kinds of hurdles. So, and contingent faculty are organizing into collective bargaining units around the country. And we're looking forward to doing more of that in the future. Right now we are in discussions with the American Federation of Teachers on an affiliation that would help the AAUP with reach more deeply into the profession than we are able to right now. And I am really looking forward to trying to organize graduate students and contingent faculty, faculty at historically Black institutions, faculty at minority serving institutions, as well as continuing to organize faculty at private institutions into AAUP chapters and or AAUP collective bargaining chapters where that's possible. But I think that's what needs to happen. The people in the profession need to organize as workers. And I feel like now is a real moment where people see that. I mean, in the past, in the long ago past, I think some members of the AAUP had doubts about collective bargaining, thinking it was for, you know, working people. But given what's happened, given what's happened to the profession over these last few decades, I don't think there's any doubt in anyone's mind anymore that collective bargaining, whether it's formal collective bargaining through the National Labor Relations Board or collective action just through an AAUP chapter, is the way to go. It's the way to build power on your campus. It's the way to make changes on your campus. I mean, the problems of contingency, they can be fought through collective action on a campus. A faculty can demand a certain fraction of the faculty must be full-time and tenured track. A faculty can demand their appropriate role in shared governance. And there's power in numbers. There's power in collective action. So I feel like at this moment in time, organizing, collective organizing is more popular. I mean, is more popular than ever. And the successes that people are seeing, you know, at Starbucks and Amazon, I hope will translate into more organizing for us. We've done organizing over the last few years. We've organized several chapters jointly with the American Federation of Teachers. And these are some of our, you know, we've organized in the University of New Mexico, University of Alaska, University of Vermont. But I think going forward, there are opportunities in the future to continue organizing those kinds of schools, but to reach more deeply into the profession and organize contingent faculty and part-time faculty. So I'm really excited about the opportunities that I see in front of us.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
When we talk about organizing and we talk about collective bargaining, can we talk about the importance of transparency? I'm thinking of a recent case where two people were hired in the same department at the same time, one male, one female, and she ultimately took it to court when she later learned by accident, if I'm remembering the case correctly, she got an email she shouldn't have, which revealed to her that the man who was hired at the same time as her was hired for the same job but at higher rate of pay. And that meant that every time he got a raise, he was exponentially doing better than she was at the point that she brought the suit. And yet they had virtually identical jobs. Without transparency, she didn't know what to bargain for as her starting salary, and she didn't know that they had felt the press that had published her book was not as prestigious as the press that had published his book, and yet it came out in the court case. They didn't research her press at all, so they had no data to show that hers wasn't as prestigious. When we lack transparency, we end up with these kind of problems, even on the tenure track.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely outrageous. And I can tell you that it's very common. Women are paid less than men. Is it that the males are negotiating for a higher salary and the women don't know to negotiate for a higher salary? I mean, that's all just, you know, bullshit. I mean, people should be that shouldn't be part of the equation. I mean, salaries should be equitable with regard to gender and race, and they're not. And the reason they're not is because of this lack of transparency. I imagine that kind of thing could be handled. I just want to say I reiterate that this is extremely common. I know of many people who have inadvertently found out that they are being paid less than other people. I found out I was being paid on average I had to fight this fight for myself, and it required, first of all, wondering was there inequity, trying to find the data to see if there was an inequity, and then once the inequity was revealed to me, fighting to get the inequity addressed. Those are many, many steps. And lots of people don't know to even, you know, look at it. People assume. I've talked to several women over the course of my career advising people who learned they were lowballed when they were hired by a dean that they later, you know, grew to admire, you know, that they admired. And then they found at the time of hiring, they were lowballed. It's really outrageous. So I'm, you know, I agree with you 100% that there should be equity in salaries. There should be transparency in salaries. There should be an obvious progression so that people stay on the same track. And that, you know, I'm a professor of mathematics, as I said at the beginning, that little thing, even the difference of $1,000 or $500 or $2,000 in base pay when you start your salary, that will translate into, you know, a very substantial amount of money by the end of a career, and also translate into a substantial difference in retirement savings. So it's not a little thing. It's a big thing. And it's, you know, it's systemic with women and also with faculty of color. It's this systemic racism that we see in the society. You know, higher education isn't immune to that. So there are also those inequities there. Not only are there those inequities in terms of starting salaries and merit pay increases, but there are also those inequities in promotion and tenure. And that's where I think faculty of color are oftentimes denied promotions denied tenure for reasons that would not result in a denial for a white person. Faculty of color we're getting off track. It's the same idea of inequity, but you know, faculty of color are often expected to work on diversity and inclusion task forces, which is extra work and overburdened with advising students of color who would naturally turn to faculty of color for help and advice. And so there's this invisible work. I've heard it called the black tax, and I agree with that 100%. There's this invisible work that burdens faculty of color, burns out faculty of color, and a white counterpart is just, you know, teaching their classes and using all their spare time for research to publish and write books. And then it's the shadow of systemic racism that ends up keeping faculty of color from the higher ranks of academia. This is another problem. This is something the AAP is deeply concerned about, and But it's a systemic problem. It's higher education is immune from it. The AAUP isn't immune from it. So we've taken on a racial equity initiative, which has involved training for the staff and the elected leaders, and we're working hard on this. But I forgot where we started with this question. But it was transparency in salaries and inequity in salaries. I think when in a collective bargaining situation, those kinds of things can be addressed because, there's typically a grievance procedure that ideally would result in some kind of binding arbitration. But organizing is a great answer to a lot of the problems that plague our profession. Grassroots organizing, and the AAUP is the national association that's been protecting the profession for 107 years, is here to help. We have tons of resources. We have statements and investigations that are considered sort of case law, air quotes, case law in the profession. I mean, the resources of the AAUP are formidable. And to get them to work, we need faculty organized on campuses to promulgate our statements and our principles and our standards. So I got, was alive. You asked me that question so long ago about transparency and salaries. But I think the bottom line is organizing on campuses based on AAU principles is one way to fight back against all the problems in our profession.
And it sounds like talking about this, the case that I'm referring to, the male professor had no idea because they had each had their interviews separately. They'd signed their contracts separately. And if I'm remembering correctly, he was actually helpful in providing information to her for the suit because he was in no part of her being underpaid while he was properly paid. That he hadn't participated in that. He hadn't known about it. And it strikes me that as we talk more and we organize more, these conversations can more organically happen. There could be far more allies out there than anyone realizes because this stuff is still hidden.
Right. I agree. I think that's also not uncommon for the male professor who was overpaid or paid higher than the female professor at the, you know, doing the same job. I absolutely would imagine that person is completely innocent of any wrongdoing here. I would blame for these kind of things. I would blame the administration who are nickel and diming, you know, hires and, you know, they're pulling the strings and looking at the overall budget and trying to save money where they can, but, saving money in this way is, I don't know how anyone could do it. It's unconscionable to do some, I don't know how anyone could do that. I also think, speaking of, finding allies in unexpected places, I think you're right. With organizing is you absolutely can, find allies in unexpected places. Faculty organizations can partner with student organizations to move forward, with staff associations. I mean, we're all, and with graduate students, you know, we're some of those groups were all workers on campus. We work there. I mean, we, during the pandemic, many of our administrations were sending us, you know, heartfelt emails thanking us for all we did to keep the institutions running during the pandemic, when really what they should have been doing was sending those emails and some kind of a bonus or, you know, course release for a few years from now, because we all believe in the mission of our institutions, but it's a job. We work there. We're workers, and we should be treated with respect like workers. We should demand the respect we deserve as workers. And so finding common ground with staff associations and graduate student associations and student groups is a way to build power and make sure that the institution lives up to its mission. I think, you know, all those groups would be all in for the missions of these institutions, which are about higher education and higher education as a common good. Another place, kind of back to where we talked about earlier in the podcast, was the problems with tenure. This may be a little inside baseball, but, you know, the attacks on tenure that I see are coming from legislators or governors. Like the Lieutenant Governor of Texas, Dan Patrick, attacked tenure. The Florida is attacking tenure. These are happening at the legislative or governor level. And they are, in my view, completely without content. They're dog whistles for the base. They have nothing to do with tenure. They are talking points that these people think they can use to get votes in the next election. Now, administrators at these institutions where tenure may be taken away because of state action, they see the danger here. And I believe that administrations, presidents and administrations of universities, as long as they're not in the pocket of the governor or the legislature, will see the danger to this these laws threatening to take away tenure, and will find common ground with the faculty. I don't know that how outspoken they'll be about their disagreement with the legislature or the governor, but I do think that presidents of institutions, as long as they're not in the pockets of the governor, and senior administration in institutions will see that these attacks on tenure will result in, will have an impact on recruiting faculty and retaining faculty. If faculty have a choice between a job where there's no tenure and the governor is anti-tenure and a job where there is tenure, they'll absolutely go to the job with tenure, because it protects academic freedom. So I think there are organizing opportunities everywhere, and there are allies everywhere. And I don't know that we've done a good enough job with the public. The AAUP and the higher ed community has done a good enough job with the public to explain the importance of higher education in a democracy, especially public higher education in a democracy, the importance of full-time faculty teaching the students, the importance of tenure to protect academic freedom, the importance of having most faculty full-time and tenure eligible, and the number of contingent faculty, you know, should be, you know, under 30%, under 10% or something for flexibility. But that's something where I don't know that we've done a good enough job, but maybe your podcast will help.
It strikes me that if we lose tenure and it becomes all contingent, for people to try to understand, it would be as though your high school was taught entirely for all 4 years by a rotating cast of substitutes.
Yeah,
because at the college level, you're just going to have a rotating group of, you know, people come in and teach the courses, but there's no one who will stay longer than a few months.
Yeah, I think that's a problem. I agree. But, you know, some contingent faculty do stay for a long time. There are long term, you know, full time contingent faculty and short term contingent faculty stay at the same place for a long time. So but what you articulate is a danger. But I think the real danger is when you've got everyone contingent and worried about whether or not they'll get a contract for next semester. So picture someone in a classroom concerned about, will I be rehired next year? Well, that's going to have an effect on conversations they have in the classroom. They may self-censor themselves on difficult conversations because they don't want students to complain about what's being discussed in the conversation. It'll likely result in grade inflation, because, you know, if you're too many students are complaining that their grades are too low, you're liable to be not hired back again. The quality of education is liable to suffer, not because the adjunct faculty don't want to do the right thing, but and many of them will do the right thing, but if you're really worried about your actual livelihood being taken away from you, then that will have an effect on how you teach, what you decide to research, whether or not you'll decide to do a research project that might take 3 or 4 years to come to fruition, because after 2 years with nothing to show for it, you know, you might be let go. So I think it is like you said, it's like and contingent faculty are liable not to have the same kind of connection to the department and the institution, like your analogy about, you know, 4 years of substitute teachers. If the institution isn't going to make the commitment to that faculty member, then I agree with you. The faculty member is less likely to make the commitment to the institution. They will make the commitment to the students, because I have never seen adjunct faculty who aren't committed to the students and to the teaching and to the subject. But the commitment to the institution is less likely to be made, and that's to the detriment of the school.
And it's to the detriment of research as well. You touched on that a moment ago, but applying for grants and fellowships, if you're contingent, a lot of those doors are shut to you. And as you said, if you're cobbling together a living amongst four different institutions in a single semester, the time and energy you have left to really do a sustained research project is greatly diminished.
Exactly right. You said it exactly right. And it's extremely depressing, and it's just exploitative. And especially, you know, to have, for the administrations and the boards of these institutions to have turned the profession of teaching in higher education into a gig economy is an outrage. And you know, as I said a few minutes earlier in the podcast, I mean, we're talking about people who have dedicated themselves to their field, to their scholarship, to teaching and researching in a field. And they've dedicated themselves to this, you know, at great personal expense of money and time. And now they end up at the other end of their education in a gig economy. It's absolutely shameful. And, you know, I hope we can, I see opportunities in the future. We're doing what we can to help organize contingent faculty. I mean, as I said, if you go onto the AAUP website, we have lots of resources for contingent faculty. And we've been working on this problem of contingency for a while, but I do see opportunities right now. I feel like it's a great time right now for organizing workers across the spectrum of jobs, and in particular in higher education.
One final thing that's, I think we've touched on, but we haven't said explicitly, is the importance of relationships. Faculty rely on each other. They get to know students. Knowledge is not something you want to do all by yourself alone. It's something that you want to share and that gets better because you've shared it. A huge part of academic freedom is letting the knowledge permeate out and to get feedback on it and to have it be this living thing that many, many people are engaging with. And the core of that is the sustained relationships.
Right. I mean, that's right. I mean, that's within the academy, you know, it's right. Departments have, there are relationships within a department, there are relationships within a field, there are relationships within classes, and these are all essential to creating knowledge, to disseminating knowledge, to moving research forward. These are essential, and I think it's in many cases why people have gone into this profession. I think there are some faculty that are just strictly researchers, but I think the vast majority of faculty went into this profession to be able to teach the next generation, to bring the next generation along, you know, the way we were brought along by our professors. So I think that relationship between faculty and students in terms of creating knowledge and creative, you know, making these students better writers, better thinkers, critical thinkers, it's probably the reason many people went into the profession, and it's probably one of the most rewarding parts of the profession is those relationships we're able to build with undergraduates and graduate students and colleagues in the department and colleagues in our fields.
And being able to be in touch with them in the future should they want to reach out. It's one of the disadvantages of being contingent. Your email address disappears when your semester of teaching is over. It's very hard to maintain connections and to even write letters of recommendation for people you'd love to write one for, but the only email address they have for you ended on the last day of that semester.
Yeah, that's really outrageous exploitation. I mean, yeah, we have. I received an email from a former student just today or yesterday, and she's teaching at a Jesuit affiliated high school in Harlem, and wanted to know did I know students who could she's going to be the chair of her high school department. I don't know when she graduated, 10, 15 years ago, but she was able to reach out to me because I still have the same email address. This contingency problem has really made the adjunctification of the profession has really made a lot of problems in the profession, not least of which what you're saying, adjunct faculty lose their email. Those students who they may have had real connections with simply cannot get in touch with them to connect, much less to ask for a letter of recommendation from someone who may know them better than anyone else in the field. My understanding is that many places adjunct faculty lose their library privileges when the last day of the semester is over. You turn in your grades and you're gone. It's how can you feel a part of the institution when they kick you to the curb like that?
And how can you keep doing your research when the library just said, I'm sorry,
right,
your card's no good.
Right, right. Yeah.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left, and I want to ask you my final question I like to ask all my guests, which is, what gives you hope?
That's a great question. I think what gives me hope is the youth of the nation in all respects. What young people are doing with respect to climate change, what young people are doing with respect to politics, what young people in my profession are doing, the organizing of graduate students all over the country, I feel like it's the youth of today. It's their world, and I am very hopeful at the activism I see in young people in the Black Lives Matter movement, in climate change movement, in particular for me, in organizing at graduate students and fighting for better working conditions and respect. That's what I'm hopeful for. That's what gives me hope. Also, what gives me hope is my own organization, the AAUP. I've been involved in the organization at various levels at my school, at my chapter level, at the state level, at the national level now for, going on 20 years. And it's an organization, there's certain organizations that give me hope, and the AAUP is one of them. The people I meet in this space are the most dedicated activists and fighting for justice, all kinds of justice, racial justice, social justice, economic justice, climate justice. So what gives me hope is my fellow activists, in particular, my fellow activists that are next generation.
Dr. Irene Mulvey, thank you so much for being on the show today and telling us about your role as the president of the American Association of University Professors and for telling us about the hidden stakes in the fight for tenure. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, and you've been listening to New Books Network. I hope you will please join us again